Hi, everybody. This is Dean Hagler from the Office.
Are we testing?
No, we're not testing. This is the show.
Did you listen to it and you adjusted accordingly?
I adjusted accordingly. Now we're perfect.
But see, you have no green levels at all. I don't need green levels.
No, look, we both have the same green levels. Don't look at the green levels as a way of checking. Look at these levels.
And it sounds good.
It sounds fantastic.
Okay, so start. Hi, everybody. This is Dean Hagler.
No, you're Phil Lernes. And this is the Your Chilpack Hollywood Hour as we discuss our audio. I'm not going to re-record that. I'm not going to.
You know what's interesting is that this week we actually had our production meeting off air.
and now we're having
our audio test on air.
That's right. As we discuss the board that we've stared at now for 250 episodes, for crying out loud.
Oh, Lord.
For the first time, you haven't realized
you're
exactly
hungover.
My audio technician.
You're hungover from wearing comedy film shorts all weekend.
I was at LA Comedy Film Shorts. Closing night party and award show where awards were given out to the best of the LA comedy film shorts, both in the screenplay division and also in the best of the fest.
What one?
Never
heard of
Bear, it. Bear Force One.
Really?
I think so, yeah.
That's funny.
Bear Force One, which is a hilarious short. It's not even short, it's actually quite a gripping feature length, but it's also based on a rare gay Amsterdam singing group that they used to sing at the end. They were called Bear Force One. And
you don't need
80s.
To tell me.
I know. I think you were a big fan of of them. And they were included in the movie.
So a feature won Best Short.
Well, it felt like a feature. So it was more than a one-joke thing. It was, you know, the president fighting bears on a plane.
You know, I'm directing a short film.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah. I'm fully immersed in the pre-production on that, having finished all our bonus features for The Truth Is Out There last week.
Look at you go.
I spent the weekend pulling even more late nights, battling back a cold, battling back a sinus infection, battling back a migraine, because there's just too much to get done.
Yeah.
Next week, I can take some time off.
Maybe.
Maybe.
Before you get to London.
Yeah, but this week, come on.
Come on.
Don't kid yourself.
I'm not kidding myself how much work there is.
And action-packed? Is that the show we have on tap?
Holy smokes. We are so packed we can't even re-record the beginning of this. That's how fast and furious this show is going.
I mentioned the documentary The Truth Is Out There, of which I mentioned.
Oh, yes. I recall that's the one I talked about going to London for.
We got another review. Got a review in the Huffington Post.
How about that?
Mark Hirschhorn wrote a rave.
It seemed like a rave.
And, hell, it might even be excerpted in the artwork, in the DVD and Blu-ray artwork.
Look at that, a call-out.
The release of The Truth Is Out There, yeah.
That's crazy talk.
Anyway, the banner headline for his review, The Truth Just Might Be In Here.
Ah.
Kind of cool.
Kind of clever.
So, thanks to Mark Hirschhorn.
We thank him immensely.
For that. That was
delightful.
Very delightful.
And I bet that stays up for a while, right? People
sure.
It was emailed me to directly, so I'm not sure. I didn't actually go through the HuffPost to find it.
I'm not, I'm not saying that this will be the overarching theme of today's show.
Uh-huh.
However, it certainly will be a subplot.
I love it.
And so this is foreshadowing. Huffington Post might come up again later in the conversation.
What?
Yeah.
That's twice in one show?
Is that that's dramatic, that foreshadowing, isn't it?
Unheard of. Oh, my gosh.
This documentary, The Truth Is Out There, this seems like a good film. And
if you do say so yourself.
It
I'm in it.
And it's, as we said, it's world premiere.
Yeah.
Is London.
Yep.
Saturday.
Yep.
30th of April.
Yep.
And we gave the wrong time last week.
What? It's not
It was not our fault. We're not going to say it's anybody's fault.
Okay, no blame is being handed out. But what time is it going to happen?
Yeah, according to the Sci-Fi London program that I'd been given,
all right,
it was 6 p.m.
Right.
But the British Film Institute, who's hosting the screening at the British Film Institute South Bank location, National Film Theater 1.
Wow.
We're playing at 5:10 p.m.
I see.
Because there is some other screening, some kind of event, some other event I feel like it's like Potemkin or something. I don't know what it is. It's some big deal. It's some. It's a real. That's Battleship, really a big deal.
Battleship Potemkin.
Some actual big deal. Yeah. Playing there after us, after our little deal.
I see.
At 8:45 p.m.
I see. Right.
So they wanted to have time for not only the 2 hours and 23 minutes of epicness that is The Truth Is Out There, a true epic of comedy, consciousness, and conspiracy. They also want time for Dean Haglund and Phil Ernest to come up and do their post-screening dog and pony show. I'll let you decide which one you are.
I'm the doggy, you're the pony. No, I'm the pony, you're the dog.
So anyway, it's going to be a really fun night. I've already heard from a lot of good folks that are going to be in attendance.
Fantastic.
Gives us a chance to see a lot of old friends. And what a fun place to be it. Having our world premiere. So 5:10 p.m. on Saturday, April 30th. We have posted links to that on both our Facebook pages, but also on the Truth Is Out There Facebook page, facebook.com/truthmovie.
Yep.
Also, a big headline that you can click on and link to the British Film Institute on our website, truth-is-out-there.com.
Right. And we're going to go on the Rob Simone show, which airs all through the UK.
We are?
Yes, you and I are going to be guests on his show.
When we're there?
Before we're there. Yeah, okay. We're going to record here, and it's going to show that we're there. And then we'll be guests perhaps on the upcoming Coast to Coast.
That's crazy talk.
That is crazy.
I think you'll be a guest, and I'll call in and ask you a question.
No, why can't you come and be a guest, too?
Rob's a great guy.
Yes.
Love Rob. Always have a good time getting to talk to him. He was so much fun. And he has a nice little...
Little spot in the movie.
As funny and delightful as it is, it also actually serves a really important function by framing some issues quite nicely.
And transitioning, and it's all great.
Transitioning is not actually the word.
It's not?
Yeah.
We're not.
Transition is the word. You're making a transition. I am so annoyed with people saying we're transitioning between this and that. No, you're making a transition between this and that.
Making a transition, but the verb...
There's no verb.
So what is the verb then if I make
There is no verb. You're making is the verb. Making a transition.
Okay. So if
transition is a noun. There is no verb form of the noun.
But
transition.
If I make a cake, I'm baking.
Right, you're not caking. You're making a cake. Right.
I'm caking. I'm just going to cake.
So
up.
You want to know what is the synonym that you can use for making a transition?
For my verb form.
I don't know. Perhaps Eddie, metamorphosizing?
Well, that does slow down my
Thank
conversation.
You, Kafka.
So anybody knows the answer to that, please email us at chillpackhollywood@yahoo.com, where we love getting everyone's emails all the time. We read them and answer them sometimes.
Indeed.
Don't we?
Indeed, yeah. Yes. Oh, if we have time, I'll read some later in the show.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
And not some spam. You're not going to read spam again.
Would I ever do that?
I don't. You enjoy reading the spam that shows up in our WordPress.
I don't know. Quite frankly, I have a hard time telling the difference. Okay.
That was a dig. What? You just burnt.
No, or I burnt me. Your friend in podcasting, Phil Lernis, is not always so quick on the uptake.
Right. This is our weirdest show ever.
We have also following the world premiere of The Truth Is Out There, there will be, of course, a U.S. premiere.
Oh,
there's
going
to be a whole bunch of screenings all around the world.
Fantastic.
Even after the DVD and the Blu-rays are available, we will still continue to travel and tour and show the film and meet with people and answer questions and ask them questions. You know, basically living our lives, because that's what we do.
Right.
As a course of action. There will be a big U.S. premiere. I think it's safe to say at this point, don't you think, the date and the location?
Why not?
It's going to be May 21st.
May
that's
21st.
Saturday.
Saturday night.
May 21st at the Retro Dome.
Retro Dome. Retro
in
Saturday.
Saratoga,
Saturday.
California.
Retro Dome. Come down, be there.
Retro Dome.
The Retro Dome in Saratoga,
Dean and Phil
California.
Enter, only one will leave. The Retro Dome. Dean Haglund and the Retro Dome. Yeah, that sounds Mad Dean and the Retro Dome. Anyway, it's this fantastic place in Saratoga, California, and we'll talk more about it and reveal more of the details, including how to get tickets. But just a little, to tease everybody who wants to know about when they can see the film here in the States. That will be the first opportunity.
That'll be the first opportunity. Saratoga, of course, up by Cupertino in your hometown.
Well, it's, yeah, it's kind of South Bay.
Yeah.
South Bay. It's closer to San Jose than it is to San Francisco, but it's on the peninsula.
Right.
A beautiful community. And
fantastic.
So
people love it. Come, mark your calendar now,
yeah,
May 25th.
And this location actually is very, was very key in my development as a filmmaker and an artist. And I will save those stories until the premiere, because we will be doing
a podcast,
a 1 hour live podcast immediately following the premiere with the full audience who's just seen the film.
Look at that.
Won't that be fun?
Won't that be fun? So it'd be as if you were there if you couldn't be there.
Now, if I can bring the room down for a moment.
You always do.
We lost a giant of cinema.
I know. A shocker.
This week. I mean, we finally got around to remembering Elizabeth Taylor last week. And so we can't let another few weeks go
by
like we did there without remembering Sidney Lumet.
Sidney Lumet died. A bit of a shocker. I thought he was still had a couple things in him, a couple years left in him.
1957, he made his first feature film. Which I think was also the year, big year for him. If I'm not mistaken, it was either 56 or 57. But even if it was 56, that would have been when he was making 12 Angry Men.
12 Angry Men.
His first feature film.
Right.
He married Gloria Vanderbilt.
Which would have been then...
That's a big deal.
Yes.
I mean, Gloria Vanderbilt, of course, for people who don't know, famous designer.
Jean designer.
Created the the modern blue jean design, right? And so designer and an actress and of course a socialite and the heir to Cornelius Vanderbilt,
and isn't the mother of Anderson Cooper
yeah, Sidney Lumet not the father,
no, but still there's a close family connection.
Isn't that anyway? So you talk about that starting off your career. I'm marrying Gloria Vanderbilt and I'm directing as my first film a whole bunch of the greatest actors in the world
in
12 Angry Men.
Yeah, exactly. And that was a stage play.
The balls it took to do either of those things, marry Gloria Vanderbilt or direct that.
When you think about how hard it is to direct that, because normally when you get a stage play, you want to, what they say, open it up and get the characters out and move the camera around. And yet here's the constraints of being stuck in a room on a rainy evening with 12 jurors. And that it never gets tired. You never see the same camera angle twice. You never get stuck.
I always forget that you are really a big fan of that film.
Yeah,
I mean you.
Yeah,
yeah,
I really think that film is really cool for a lot of reasons. And then some acting choices I would have done differently.
Right.
But so much of it is it's claustrophobic, and yet it breathes. It's not. The problem of getting your camera stuck when you're at a stage play, just doing, over the shoulder.
Right.
How many times do you see that shot? But you never feel that in that movie at all.
And yet you do get what I think is best about seeing a stage production when it's well mounted. You do get the sense of, like you said, the claustrophobia and the pressure and the stress and the unrelenting nature of time.
Right.
In that piece. This clock is ticking. Even though it's a 2-hour movie, you really feel like, oh my God, we've been in this for a while.
The pressure.
So that's amazing. His last film, because I don't like to deal strictly in the positive, as you know, here on Your Chill Pack Hollywood.
Of course.
His last film, I could not have been looking forward to more. It starred Philip Seymour Hoffman and Marissa Tomei. It was Before the Devil Knows You're Dead.
Oh yeah,
and little story about this. I took Lily to go see it.
Oh yes,
and Lily wasn't familiar with Sidney Lumet's work because his classics all date back more than 30 years ago now.
Right.
But so I told her what these
exciting
were, and
films.
So she was really, really excited to be seeing this. Then I mean, Philip Seymour Hoffman, Sidney Lumet, Before the Devil Knows You're Dead. Wow. And I spent the rest of the night apologizing. What a dog that thing was.
Wow, I don't think I saw
such
it.
Such a disappointment. Anyway, but in between those
films... Oh my gosh.
Films,
Hello, Serpico, Dog Day Afternoon. I mean, look at just the camera work in Dog Day Afternoon. Just every shot the camera, or there's movement going on in what is a stalemate hostage-taking situation. Again, a problem for filmmakers where everybody's bogged down, and yet that move just freaking sparkles. It moves. There's action all the time.
And the pressure, again, the sense of constant pressure that characters are under that reveals their humanity.
Yeah.
It might reveal the ugliness of their humanity. It also might compassion is a word that comes to mind a lot in terms of how Lumet, you know, depicted these characters and what happened to them under pressure. Mm-hmm. He had compassion for these characters, for all of his characters. Right. And I think the audience ends up, you know, certainly at Lumet's best, having compassion for all of them as well.
Yeah.
You mentioned a couple of the biggies, but I also, how about some of the ones that don't get remembered, I think maybe as much as they should now? The Pawnbroker? Rod Steiger?
Oh, my God. I forgot about
that. Failsafe? Again with Henry Fonda. And you always loved Larry Hagman.
Larry Hagman in that thing.
Am I wrong in thinking that Failsafe does not or has not maintained the level of cultural awareness that it might have because of Dr. Strangelove?
I think so. I mean,
the premise is so similar.
So similar. Yeah, and that the one... the failsafe has such gravity to it that just is unrelenting.
And again, pressure. How the characters are revealed through these pressure-packed situations. Mm-hmm. And that's why I love that you enjoy Larry Hagman in it so much, because really that relationship between Larry Hagman as the translator and Henry Fonda as the president who has to speak to the Russian premier through his translator, Larry Hagman, their relationship... reveals
so much
important stuff. It reveals the humanity of the film.
Yeah, totally.
So you have Failsafe. One of my, not favorite films, but really a film that I love to watch almost every year, and I spend the first half of it always going, how is this not, never mind considered one of the greatest mysteries, but how is this just not considered one of the greatest films of all time? It's so wonderful and so much fun. And that's Murder on the Orient Express.
Oh, yeah.
And then there's the second half, and then I go, oh, I see why it's not one of the greatest films of all time. I mean, it's because you kind of get locked into, okay, here's how it was done.
Right. And now we solve it.
But boy, at its best, it is such stylish, wonderful entertainment with the biggest movie stars in the world.
At the time, yeah. And
maybe only a guy like Sidney Lumet could pull that off. And one of the things that is so delightful is Albert Finney, who is unrecognizable in the character of Hercule Poirot, at the end of the film, all alone. You know, it's one of those whodunits, locked room, all the suspects in the room. Here, we're going to tell you how it was done. But I just love it, not from a plot standpoint, not from a story... any of this, or even an acting standpoint, I just love that they cast the biggest, most expensive movie stars in the world to be absolutely silent and not get to say a word. Well, Albert Finney does everything. We're paying them top dollar to sit
down and shut up. That's right. And again, a testament in close space filmmaking. And you know, now that you mention it, even Failsafe, all that's in the little President bomb shelter room, it is all of these things. I'm going to rewatch for that sort of thing because it is phenomenal.
He used Sidney Lumet, the big screen to tell stories of intimacy, claustrophobia, pressure, revealing humanity, which, you know, is really interesting. They you could think of them as kind of these small canvases.
Yeah.
But they were huge stories. I mean, think about Nuclear Armageddon, the big bank robbery.
Yeah, murder.
An all-star murder mystery. all these things. Those are big canvases.
Yeah.
But they were these kind of claustrophobic, pressure-packed things on a big screen.
On a big screen.
And that combination worked fantastic.
And I got to think, even just the technical, I mean, back in the 70s, those Panavision cameras were huge monstrosities, and you didn't have a Steadicam pack or anything like that. So you had to, like, lay down your tripod sticks, light the damn thing. How much room did you pack in technical equipment and all those actors to get those scenes? I can't even imagine now that I think about it.
And again, everything else aside, boy, he got great performances from people, and Network. getting great performances.
Yeah. An
Oscar-winning performance posthumously from Peter Finch.
Yep.
A wonderful performance from William Holden, Faye Dunaway. The Verdict.
Oh, yeah.
A film
Paul that Newman.
Possibly should have won Newman his Oscar.
Yeah.
For The Verdict. Sidney Lumet wrote and directed the Vin Diesel vehicle, Find Me Guilty.
Did he really?
Yeah. I shouldn't have closed on that one. Anyway, well, then how about I close with this. One of the most sadly overlooked Sidney Lumet gems, Running on Empty, featuring fantastic performances from Christine Lottie and River Phoenix.
Yeah.
And so if you haven't seen that,
that's a good one to get.
It's a great reminder also of what we lost with the death of River Phoenix.
Right.
Because he was really a gifted.
Really, really good in that. Huh. Okay, there you go.
I've been wanting to ask you, have you seen the video for Friday?
Yeah, the original one?
We've never talked about this. Rebecca Black's Friday.
Shall we get into the pop culture phenom?
I want to talk about that because somehow, first of all, I guess because I've been making a movie and then making all these bonus features, I didn't know about it.
Right.
And
it's easy not to know about it unless you like are combing huge amounts of the...
But I checked on Friday, which is the day after Thursday.
Right. Fun.
And we, so excited. 95 million people have seen it now on YouTube. Those are unique views.
Right.
95 million unique views.
However.
It was estimated
on
Today's show last week that 1 in 3 Americans has seen it.
Okay.
Imagine that. That's more than watch the Super Bowl.
Right. However, because it is mocked so much, everybody's going back to see the original. I think it's the sheer amount of mockery that the thing is getting.
Possibly, but first of all, on YouTube, over a certain number of hits, you get paid for every view. Of course, people are buying this song like crazy. It's a huge moneymaker.
Who's buying
that song?
A huge
amount of money. And this is what I'm fascinated by this for a couple of surprising reasons.
I'm surprised that you're even talking about this.
It is so hated.
Yeah.
As you said, it's the thing that people are loving to hate, really. But it's so hated that YouTube has turned off the dislike function on it. I'm serious.
They turned
it off. You can't say that you dislike it because the ratio is too extraordinarily to the dislike.
Oh, my God.
The comments are the most seething and vile and hostile and occasionally funny things ever. But this was the most amazing thing to me. I'd never seen it before. My friends, the Baker Boys, who sometimes I watch after, they in Altadena, they two of them are high school kids. They felt the need to show me this.
Right, to keep you connected to your culture.
Keep me connected, exactly. Yeah. What I loved was we watched it. We then looked at some of the comments. In the amount of time it took us to read two comments, and these are not long comments.
No.
You're like, I'll do one of the clean ones.
Right.
I will never look forward to the weekend ever again, was a comment that someone... Very funny, right?
Very funny.
Anyway, in the amount of time it took us to read two comments at about 11:30 at night here on the West Coast.
Okay.
So 2:30 in the morning there on the East Coast.
Yeah.
Late at night throughout the United States.
Very good.
The amount of time it took us to read those two, 15 more comments were posted.
Wow.
While we were reading two. That's how fast, after all this time, people are still coming to this thing.
Well, I think they're coming to it more. I mean, the Stephen Colbert, Jimmy Fallon, epic redo of that song, I thought was actually really fantastic.
I knew none of any of
them. See? This was a fundraiser to raise money for a charity, and that if they hit a mark of 26,000, then Jimmy Fallon said, oh, yeah, well, then Stephen Colbert is going to come on my show and sing Friday, to which they had this sort of battling thing all week. And then sure enough, they come on with the Roots and Dancing Girls and Taylor Hicks from one of the winners of American Idol. Like, it was just his pop culture hilarity that was awesome.
Now, everybody's saying, I mean, this is universally hailed as the worst song of all time.
Yes. But when they did it, it seemed like a real uplifting, up people kind of generic.
I want to know, though, first of all, I had a hard time
determining,
really thinking that it was the worst song ever because it sounds just like every other song.
Well, this is it.
I mean, this auto-tune thing, am I wrong? Don't they all just sound...
They're all the same now. Auto-tune is
I sound like the old man going, all that music all sounds the same. But they're designed to sound the same.
Right. That you can actually modulate your voice. So if you're off key, the computer will put you on key and even change your pitch.
It's the way that Muzak, Elevator, or Dentist Office versions of adult contemporary songs were all designed to sound exactly the same.
Yeah, right.
To keep you in a certain relaxed mood.
Right.
This is
designed to irritate you. But it's also for, theoretically, artists who have an off day or are performing live, the auto-tune can work in real time. They can also, apparently, to the military, change your voice pattern so that you can sound like anyone else in the world.
Well, fascinating. And again, technology, one of my favorite things, which is, there is so much technology, so many inventions that could really change and help us, things like the Chill Pack, and they're not allowed to live a thriving life because there is no marketplace built based on things that will help us.
Right.
If an invention or an innovation, perhaps more to the point, is going to find a foothold in the marketplace, that foothold has to be proved through either entertainment or military applications,
right.
or both,
entertainingly military.
And but you just talked about how auto-tune has both.
Yeah.
But here's the thing: from the auto-tune, I can understand where in a film, think about an actor losing his voice or having a hard time. Actors get sick on the set of a show. It always bugs me when I'm watching reruns of shows and I can tell, the actor had a cold that day.
Right.
You'd be able to start helping yourself with that without needing to ADR things.
Or think about a difficult actor. Like I had a friend who was a professional comedian who did very good impersonations and would get called into ADR specifically to do impersonations of actors who are too difficult or refusing or... negotiations broke down in the middle of the movie and refused to finish the movie.
Or sometimes even died.
Or died.
Been cases, maybe not your friend, but there have been famous cases where films needed to be finished after an actor had died during it. And so they had to get sound-alikes to come in and finish
that thing. And now with auto-tune, you would be able to get that pattern and do that automatically.
All these things, though, are great tools if, even with the military application, if they can't be noticed.
Right.
They are now being used to be noticed.
Right.
Intentionally make you feel like this singer sounds like another singer you might like.
Right. Because there is also a piece of software that the record industry uses that plugs in a song and then will determine elements of it and then land it in a pattern to determine if that song is going to be a hit or not based on if it sounds like other songs. So... you're back to square one, that your technology is determining your culture as opposed to the other way around.
So here's just a few of the lyrics to the song. Okay. And then I want to ask you a couple of questions about I'm just going to give a couple of lyrics. It's Friday, mm-hmm. Got to get down on Friday. Okay. Everybody's looking forward to the weekend. Yesterday was Thursday. Today it is Friday. Partying. We so excited. We gonna have a ball today. All right. So, the worst song of all time. I don't get it. I don't even understand why people hate this. To be honest with you,
it's no worse than Do Run Run or Bebop Shaluba.
Yeah. Culturally, our bar has been set so low.
There's no bar left.
How is it this that has everybody up in arms outraged about how terrible it is?
I think it's a cultural pylon. I think this is just some sort of meme that everyone went, oh, yeah, let's all make fun of this. Regardless, it could have just gone the other way as well. Everybody can say, oh, isn't this completely adorable? That Rebecca Black could have been another Justin Bieber, theoretically. And then the tables would have gone the opposite direction. Sort of like Octomom. Remember when Octomom, the crazy welfare...
Corman movie?
No. The actual woman who
I'm
had...
I'm thinking Sharktopus. I'm sorry.
Sharktopus. Completely different. No, the woman who had 8 children through fertility. And when the cameras first went there, it was supposed to be, a lovely story of a mother and their children and 8 of them. And they're all together in the house and they're making it happen. And then two or three people turned, and suddenly the news reporters went, "Oh my God, we got this story all wrong." And then, like the next day, it's like, "Oh my God, she's a crazy idiot who's somehow, and the doctor's immoral for doing this sort of thing." But originally, that was supposed to be a heartfelt story,
heartrending story. I just don't understand. I'm here. I'm the guy sitting off to the side, seeing how low culturally the bar has fallen.
Yep.
You know, I mean, when everybody piles on about how bad something is, I'm thinking, really, that's what it is that got your attention? Did you notice that Transformers made $400 million? I mean, exactly. The bar could not be lower.
There's no bar anymore. It's an infinite vacuum of downward spiral.
And this is what's happening. What I do love, though, is that – or another example of this, maybe even instead of comparing apples to oranges, i.e. a song to Transformers, which I guess is more like comparing – steaming piles of crap, but within the same family, let's say, I thought it was interesting that for the first time ever, a Real Housewives series on Bravo. These are for our fans listening overseas. This is a reality series, what do you call it? A series of reality series.
Yes, a grouping.
A franchise. CSI, the CSI of reality shows. Law and Order of reality shows.
Yeah.
The
Real Housewives of different neighborhoods.
Different area.
Yeah.
And for the first time ever, one of these was canceled in its first season.
Nah.
And that's Real Housewives of Washington, D.C.
And you can see why.
And I don't understand, like even how would you
know to cancel it?
That one. I mean, what was it that the audience said, "Oh, that one's bad"?
Well, I guess...
Is it just overkill, or is it... I mean, I don't understand, because I don't understand the appeal of
any of them. I don't know why anybody... I mean, after watching the situation bomb on the Donald Trump roast, and you just go, yeah, exactly. Who thought he could get up and do jokes at a roast alongside Jeffrey Ross and like professional comedians, and then you stick The Situation, who is some guy off of Jersey Shore or something like that, and of course he gets nearly booed off the stage, which is remarkable for a celebrity roast that, you know, I'm with you. I don't understand.
So all these auto-tune songs by these teeny bobbers, you know, all these sound exactly the same to me. Mm-hmm. So, okay, you want to say that these lyrics are ridiculous. Is anyone listening to any of these people for the lyrics that they're singing? Now, does it surprise you that there is a copyright lawsuit over the term Friday? Over the copyright for the lyrics. There's a huge battle going on over the copyright for the song publishing and the lyrics of Friday. Because, again, it doesn't surprise me because, of course, it's made so much money.
Right. So
it's worth something. So let's fight over it. But I love that there are people who are fighting it saying, no, I wrote the worst song ever made. I did. It's like they're truly, you know, there's no such thing as bad publicity.
Right.
You know, just as long as they spell your name right.
Well, and it's like that movie The Room, where now the director is trying to come forward saying, I intended it as a comedy. And then another guy saying, no, I actually directed this because the actor who said he directed it was in fact unable to direct it. So I was the director,
that's
but
crazy.
Uncredited. And so he's trying to get credit for The Room, which is the worst movie ever. Same idea.
Another kind of legal thing that leaves me scratching its head, and you would know whether this actually makes any sense or not.
Okay. My legal expertise on the board.
Charlie Sheen is trying to trademark his catchphrases.
Yeah. Yeah. Winning and...
Duh winning.
Duh winning, yeah. And Warlock.
Winning or Warlock from Mars or something like this. Does this make sense? Can he do this? Now that these are already out on T-shirts everywhere that people have been making, can that genie ever go back in the bottle? Can he trademark it? Can he? Oh,
yes, he can. He can. In fact, because I would say duh winning is enough of like Homer Simpson going dough that you can trademark that so that if it appears on shirts, there is a license fee to pay. However, back to Donald Trump, he tried to trademark "You're Fired" from The Apprentice. right? Because that was showing up on billboards and stuff like that. So he wanted a piece of that action. However, he couldn't do that because that technically is just two words of the English language that would show up in other formats. So he lost that battle. But duh, comma, winning, exclamation mark, potentially Charlie Sheen has a case.
Provided
it's... he's got a lawyer, and that then they have to go and chase down every T-shirt that already has that on there.
Fascinating.
Yeah. And then get a forensic
accountant. But if one of these people, made this T-shirt and could show that they produced that T-shirt prior to him Charlie Sheen ever saying it, well then
yeah.
That,
yeah.
That torpedoes the torpedo of truth.
And I don't know how the retroactive aspect of that works. If you you probably can't claim previous sales, but future sales or cease and desist at that point. So, but you know, again, what kind of shelf life do these things have?
Did you see anything this in the last week? Any movies?
I did. Let's see.
You didn't. No, nor has the viewing public.
Yes.
I mean, the box office has been just cratering.
Yeah.
And you know, and it's not because of the economy. The economy has been getting better, and indeed, box office was fine when the economy was bad. It's just really, boy, there is nothing that people want to see. Our old friend Josh Mandel, programmer at Slam Dance, a great guy. He tweeted about this and said, you know, Hollywood needs to learn that, you know, there's more in the world other than just 12 to 15 year olds. Right.
Yeah.
But the interesting thing is that, you know, that's not the problem. They've always been catering to 12 to 15-year-olds. I think the problem is that 12 to 15-year-olds don't go to movies.
Don't go to movies anymore. They don't even care. They're watching
they
it on
don't
the
care. That's, yeah. That's just, it's a paradigm that's been dead for so long.
Right.
But nobody knows what else to do.
Right.
To try to appeal, you know, to a four-quadrant hit or whatever.
Yeah, except try market then to people who still go to movies, which is around our age, you know, that... not even 18-34, the 30, what is the other age bracket? 32 to 61 or whatever.
Yeah, I don't know.
You know, these marketing breakdowns, I don't understand. But yeah, well.
And so, you know, there's just such desperation. Do you sense the desperation on the
studio part?
Like, you'll read this development news, and, you know, I'll pick on sequels and remakes and things like this sometimes. But really, when you read that. Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure 3, or Bill and Ted's 3 is about to be announced. And you just have to kind of say, boy, people are desperate. Everyone's desperate. I mean, just give us something with some built-in audience and we'll make it.
Yeah, exactly. I think there's also a computer program that now is going backwards through the entire film libraries, determining what has had some sort of...
Who's still alive.
And then what had a four-quadrant, you know, message to it that they can then reinvigorate or reimagine in some capacity. And it's quite sad.
And another story about this, like the desperation and the that when a film does make money and is successful, especially if it's surprisingly successful, like the independent hit Black Swan, which was an overwhelming box office, never mind the critical success of it, but an overwhelming box office smash.
Right.
Not by indie standards, by any standards. It was a box office smash.
Yeah.
And now there's lawsuits over, as of course there always
are, always
over
is.
Profits. But this is the first time I can ever remember. This is such a bizarre lawsuit where overnight... a production company, Overnight LLC, is suing Aaron Kaufman for not allowing them to make Black Swan. You know how the old adage that you never get fired in Hollywood for saying no to a project?
Right.
Here's a guy who's basically being sued because...
He said no to...
Because, the project didn't come together, so the project went elsewhere.
Right.
And now they're suing the guy who they blame for not allowing the project to come together because otherwise they would have made the film and they would have been raking in the profits.
Wait a sec.
Isn't that the most bizarre thing?
Yeah. So I'd like to sue Star Wars for not
letting
me be the
backer of it.
Exactly.
Exactly. I would have.
I would have totally backed that
sucker.
No,
I mean, they were involved in discussions on it. And now Aaron Kaufman is in a position. I don't know who's right or who's wrong or whatever. It's just the most ludicrous lawsuit, though. And just on the face of it, you didn't make the film. Move on. If you don't want to work with that guy because he failed, well, then you replace him, right? You work with someone else.
But it's about
the
money.
But this is basically about a guy who does get is getting in trouble for having said no to something. His point was that he actually did try to put the deal together, but the head honchos at Overnight made the financial reality of it untenable.
Right.
And the filmmakers had to go elsewhere.
Right. Which is a standard thing.
It's just such desperation.
Well, yeah. And it's also, you know, Nina Vardalos, when she made Big Fat Greek Wedding and it went to $300 million, suddenly all these lawsuits, ludicrous lawsuits, started coming out of the woodwork. 8, as I recall, and I'm sure there were more that I didn't hear about. But this is the case of where something is a financial success, you sue just as a matter of course if you have any connection to it because, A, they don't want to lawyer up, so they'll throw cash at you, and you get some cash out of a giant financial success. Or B, if you even have a legitimate claim, you then are in the trades as the company that's involved in this.
And I love that. Again, there's another independent film that is a huge box office smash, and so there's lawsuits all over the money. Instead of any lessons being made from it, which is that maybe people want to see romantic comedies, and then the studios churn out all these romantic comedies, and it becomes the law of diminishing returns. Oh, nobody wants to see romantic comedies. Right. As opposed to maybe nobody wants to see romantic comedies made by
studio idiots,
or by a marketing department that's decided, hey, let's do a whole lot of testing and then figure out the permutations for how to make a film about what it might be like to experience a genuine emotion.
Right, because then you auto-tune your movie, basically.
So I find it fascinating, though, when there are kind of new ideas and interesting ways in which these ripples are being felt in the mainstream of the Hollywood business from the independents, no bigger ripple to me than Film Independent, the organization behind the Indie Spirit Awards.
Right.
Anyway, Film Independent's CEO, Don Hudson?
Don Hudson?
Yeah, being named to take over the head of the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences.
No way. I didn't hear
Film that. Film Independent CEO is now in charge of the Academy, the most mainstream organization.
Isn't that something?
But doesn't that make sense on two fronts? First of all, we're going to expand the amount of films to 10 nominees for Best Picture because that'll give studios a bigger chance.
Right.
Or it just gives independents a better chance to get more nominations.
Yeah, exactly.
Because they're better.
The studios still aren't making good movies.
And the other thing about it is Film Independent regularly turns out a good award show, an entertaining award show.
Right, where there's somebody
fun. So how smart is it to see if maybe the people who are doing good shows can figure out how to do that with the Academy?
It's true. Where else do you have that much talent put out that bad a show?
Yeah.
Like, you even think of the Grammys. Like, there's hardly any awards given out. It's all musicians playing and stuff like that. So I don't.
So that's really, really interesting.
Pretty exciting.
In terms of again, the panic over how to get audiences to see these things and to make money off these things, boy, the knee jerk reaction on the part of studios to create video on demand window, I guess, is it through DirecTV?
DirecTV is one. Yeah, there's a couple others.
But anyway, 60 days after their release in theaters, these films will be available. Video on demand, even if they're still in theaters,
right.
Video on demand for $30 rentals,
right.
Which sounds like a lot of money, but really, if you and I went tonight to the Arclight, and why don't you and I tonight go to the Arclight?
I got
that
plans.
Would cost $30 for us to see a film.
Right.
So it isn't that much. And now, of course, with people having
HD
and these huge screens and everything,
surround sound,
you can charge admission.
I might as well
make some money.
Please do.
But of course, the theaters are outraged.
Yes.
By this, with really good reason. And so there's such interesting battles taking place between content providers and Netflix, between the theaters and the film studios. We talked before about AMC and Regal Cinemas starting their own acquisitions to release independent films.
Right, to sidestep the studios that are just... Because, as you said, the contracts that they have is that there's a law of diminishing returns. So if a movie's a sleeper hit, the studio actually makes less money than if it's a...
The longer it's in theaters.
The longer it's in theaters.
The percentage goes down.
Yeah,
the,
each week.
Right.
So
incrementally, it goes down.
That by the end of like week six, they're making less than 10% of the box office.
And I've been talking, I've talked about this before, but it bears repeating. You know, when people complain about how movie theaters charge so much for concessions, it is absolutely true that it is only the concessions that keep the theaters in business.
Right.
It's not the ticket dollar, because most of these films don't stay in theaters very long anymore. And most of the money in the opening week and the opening month goes to the distributor.
Mm-hmm.
The theater's hope is that these films will be successful enough that enough people will come in and buy concessions, and that's what allows them to stay in business, which is why we see so many big theater chains going out of business.
Right.
Because the big crowds aren't going.
And the food's crappy. That's what the Arclight at least does. They have that delicious sausage, German sausage. Whoa, my God, the apple sausage hot dog thing.
Are we sponsored by Arclight now? We should be. Wouldn't that be awesome?
Delicious. Why don't we give them a call? I could have one of them apple sausage things right now.
So I'm always interested whenever anybody has a kind of a new distribution methodology,
model, yes.
Be it the studios, be it the theaters. How about a university? Chapman University here in Southern California, has started its own micro-budget, youth-oriented production and distribution arm for former students.
Wow.
From their program, they will make these micro-budget, youth-oriented films that embrace new media.
Huh.
And they'll distribute these. You know, your friends, the festival award-winning film starring Lily Holloman and directed by Jeff Phillips, who's a professor at Chapman University, really seems to fit that mold. It's not a part of it because he's not a former student. But it almost seems like they're basing it on the kind of movie he made, because there's a movie that's all about new media. Not only does it use new media, it's about
new media. Yeah.
And it absolutely fits that methodology.
Right.
But these micro-budget things. So that's fascinating.
That is fascinating. And it's a good idea, too.
It'll be produced, I guess. I mean, I haven't delved into this too much because I'm not a former student of Chapman.
Right.
Nor do they sponsor us. However, I guess it's because, the university itself owns resources.
Yeah.
And they combine those resources with grants.
Yes.
Alumni grants.
They also have,
how they produce the film.
And they also then have a huge email. Every student, every faculty, every alumni would be in a giant database that they can then directly access for these films to find that distribution. Because that's always what you want in a distribution arm, is find that initial audience, so that you don't have to do your expensive, broad advertising, hoping to hit some eyes, but instead laser focus, narrow focus your marketing to the people who will actually come to your movie.
Now, one of the things that we haven't had a chance to talk about in quite a while is television.
Oh, yes.
Is there anything new you've been watching on TV?
Well, new, actually, I've been watching...
Or not even new television, but something that you've discovered.
Prime Suspect. Helen Mirren's Prime Suspect are showing again. And man, that is still holding up as a really great cop show.
Well, and that's interesting, because isn't that being remade here, imported to the U.S. as Prime Suspect with, I think it's Elizabeth Banks? Is Elizabeth
maybe
Banks playing the part here?
Could be. It seems that...
It's coming to series, though, next year.
Oh, it is.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's... well, to me, it's the model for The Closer, which has a...
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, it's almost identical in a lot of its feel and formatting. So that's what I'm watching. But why? What should I be watching?
Well, no, I it's an interesting time again for television. I think about, although isn't it interesting that in the wake of what's going on with film business, it almost seems like television is the model of consistency.
And, I know.
And, you
it's
know,
where the writers go to now.
But Mad Men... a show that I've loved for many years.
Many years.
Now will not be back until 2012.
Wow.
It'll have been 17 months between episodes.
Yikes.
For that show. But it is secure to go three more years and finish after a seventh season. So that's good news. I do think it was interesting that the creator of the show was so opposed to them doing product integration to pay for such an expensive show.
Yeah.
And we were kind of thinking, you know, fans of it going, he should be really open to this because that could be cool.
That could be cool, the whole marketing thing. It's sort of retro, too, into the...
I think it's very interesting that the first and the last episode of the season will maintain the episode length of 47 minutes. It's the longest show on television. It'll maintain, the first and the last will maintain 47 minutes. All the others will be 45 minutes when broadcast, but 47 minutes streaming and on DVD.
Wow.
That seems like a dumb call for me on the part of AMC because they're almost encouraging you just to watch it online.
Just watch it online.
Yeah, or on demand, video on demand.
Yeah.
Or...
Well...
But of course, AMC does put in commercials on their video on demand broadcasts of it,
yeah.
But still...
And the thing about video on demand is I think they could charge more for those commercials because you can't go past them.
They say that. They say that every video on demand thing I watch is the fast forward function is deactivated during this video on demand presentation. Have you ever tried to fast forward?
No.
It works.
Oh, it does?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah, I think it's just a disclaimer.
When I'm streaming, though, I can't get past those initial 15-second...
That's true, the initial ones. Yeah, online. Those, but that's different than video on demand.
Yeah, true.
The other show that you know I've loved for many years now that I sadly think maybe has jumped the shark is 30 Rock.
Oh, yeah.
And I found it very interesting that Alec Baldwin announced to the end of the show that next year, the end of next year would be the end of the show.
Right.
And then Not So Fast said everyone associated with the show, no, it won't be, including the network.
Right.
And he just posted on, hello, foreshadowing, the Huffington Post. That he hopes the show will go five more seasons. Here's to five more seasons of 30 Rock, even though I will not be on the show after next year. I think he's really itching to go on to other things.
Right.
Or it's the negotiation ploy of all time.
Right.
And let's get that game started now.
Now.
And if it's not a ploy, at least it gives them a good amount of time to write him out in a very interesting way.
Yep.
Which brings to mind what they're doing on The Office. Steve Carell, it's winding up its seventh season. The Office is going to come back, even though Steve Carell is leaving.
Yep.
And this whole dynamic of who will replace him maybe isn't the excitement generator along the lines of who shot JR, but it has me interested, and you know I'm not even a fan of The Office.
Right. But you're now going to watch it to see these other characters.
I've been watching it, and I'm watching it. You know, Ricky Gervais is returning for the final episodes.
Wow.
There's all these people vying to replace the character that Steve Carell plays as the manager of The Office.
Interesting.
And some of these actors, Will Ferrell, who will be in
big
the
name.
Final four episodes, and who claims, if you can believe him, that he really wants to be the guy next season on the show.
That's something.
But... he might just be saying that to promote the show. Who knows, right? But you also have some other actors who are appearing in the final episode, vying to take over The Office, including Will Arnett.
Will Arnett.
Who I think is kind
awesome.
Of a perfect call.
Totally perfect call.
Ray Romano.
What?
Who will appear in an job interview for the job in the last episode.
I thought he was doing that other series.
He has another series, Men of a Certain Age, which makes it unlikely that
right.
he might just be a red herring.
And didn't he make $50 million one season in the last season of Everybody Loves Raymond? Does he really need to go back to television?
Catherine Tate, an alum of Doctor Who.
Oh, yeah.
Maybe a woman leading the role. Some people think that she's really got good odds on taking over this show.
That's interesting.
And then... a very interesting one who seems to me to be really interesting casting and also certainly he's willing to come back to television. He did a pilot that did not get picked up. And that's
Clive
James Spader.
Oh.
Will be on the last episode. So a lot of suspects.
Wow.
It's like we need to Hercule Poirot to tell us who did it
who
and
did
who will
it?
Continue to
Ooh,
do it next year
wow.
on The Very Funny The Office.
Wow.
So that's
James Spader. I can't.
So I'm excited about watching these final episodes, and
okay.
if they win me over in a way that the show hasn't, because you know the thing though is that this mockumentary format doesn't make any sense to me anymore on
right.
the show.
Yeah, it's like The Onion said. Okay, documentary crew says, yeah, we're good. We got enough from The Office. They're leaving. Just like,
I though have watched much of season one, it's now in season two, but much of season one of Hot in Cleveland.
Yes. I've been watching that too. Patty picked it up and she...
Lily enjoys the show. I like that we're shuffling it off. We watch it with our ladies.
Exactly. I wouldn't have watched it on my own.
It is pleasing even when it is not particularly funny.
Right.
There is something comforting in the multiple camera format.
Yes. A genuineness in the camaraderie, the chemistry between them
all. The chemistry is genuine.
Betty
all
White.
All of these, the three lead ladies, Wendy Malick, Valerie Bertinelli,
yep.
who I still have a crush on.
Still?
And is it Perry Gilpin?
Gilpin, I believe yeah. it is, yeah.
From Frasier.
From Frasier, yes.
All three of these are wickedly... Seasoned but wickedly gifted comedic performer.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then you throw in Betty White, who half of what she says actually makes me laugh.
I know, right?
Because I do not see it. Somehow I don't see it coming. And even when I do see it coming, her delivery just delights me.
I know. It is surprising and very acerbic.
And I just got to tell you, it feels good to actually like a traditional sitcom.
I know. And it's on... TV Land?
Is it's that, on TV Land.
That's the thing. It's just like the rerun channel saved enough money from showing reruns that they could fund
and now they're producing
series.
Other series. They've got one retired at 35 with George Segal and Jessica Walter.
Yeah, I haven't seen that
I haven't
one.
Seen it yet, but the previews look kind of funny.
There you go. Good for TV Land.
So I got into that. And the other show that I've gotten into this year, our loyal listener Matt Giles had been pressuring me to get into this show for a while. I watched some of season one on DVD and admitted that it was a good show.
Oh?
It was not required viewing, however.
Oh.
But
what?
That doesn't necessarily matter because we've talked about before longingly remembering the good old days of... Not that long ago, like
right.
10 years ago.
10 years ago.
How about the X-Files? Even
yeah,
where shows didn't have to be, they didn't have to hit the ground running. They could find themselves.
Give it a year or two.
Give it a year or two.
Right.
You know, take a show with promise. Take a show that's pretty good and see what can happen.
Yeah.
And I would say that Justified was pretty good in its first season.
Uh huh.
It has been consistently good in its second season and occasionally. Great.
Wow.
It just won a Peabody Award for Excellence in Broadcasting.
That's
the show
incredible.
Stars Timothy Oliphant as a deputy U.S. Marshal in mm-hmm. Kentucky. The supporting cast around him this season includes, well, my good friend Pete Murnick as Trooper Tom.
Trooper
Bergen,
Tom.
Who's
love it.
Fantastic. Especially because the character that Timothy Oliphant plays in this show, when I first watched it last season before yeah. Pete was on this show, I said... Geez, somebody's making a show about Peter Murnick. Because this is the closest I've ever seen to Pete Murnick and on a TV show. But the supporting cast, Jeremy Davies, Walter Goggins, the acting that these men are doing is extraordinary. But the women on the show, like Linda Geringer as Timothy Oliphant's aunt, and especially Margot Martindale, who if she does not win... an Emmy for Best Supporting Actress, they ought to just not bother holding awards. Because if you're not watching Justified, and you're therefore not seeing Margot Martindale's performance on this show, you are missing the best acting on television, hands down.
I am not walking. I am running to my TiVo right now.
It is so
and
fun.
And layering that
show. It is so fun. You
and
can
it's
start
funny,
with season two.
Yeah.
There will be story threads for the first couple episodes from last season that you're not quite clear on, but episode one of season two does introduce a whole new storyline for season two. So it is one of those things where the longer you get into season two,
the more
you begin
off.
To know everything. And then if you decide to go back and watch season one, it's still enjoyable.
Wow.
It's not like,
and they're not sponsoring us.
Yes, it's incredibly funny. Timothy Oliphant plays the character within a very narrow frame, but there is a real effortless, not only charm, but humor to it. But the performance by this actor, Walter Goggins, it's so funny. The show is wonderfully funny. It's really exciting. It is, of course, violent.
Yeah.
It's an action show. It's a suspense show. It's a character drama, and it's a comedy, and it's sexy, and it's Justified. It's on FX. It's going to be wrapping up its second season. It's already been renewed for a third season, and it's one of the best that's on the
Suddenly,
air.
It's on my TiVo. There you go.
Speaking of
on your
the
TiVo.
Best on the air.
This has been another episode.
There's actually a new podcast that I'm listening to called The Succotash Show.
Oh, yes. I've heard of that.
It's kind of the talk soup. Remember talk soup?
I remember talk
the
soup.
The talk soup of podcasts.
Comedy podcasts.
Of comedy podcasts. Yep. It hips you to many of the comedy podcasts that are out there.
Right.
And lets you know week to week some of the highlights on each of those comedy podcasts.
Fantastic.
That are going to be coming.
Think of this time saving.
And one of the shows, by the way, that has been prominently featured
yes.
as a comedy podcast worthy of your time, although it's admitted by the host that it's not a comedy podcast, but nevertheless funny and worthy of your time, is your Chilpack Hollywood
Hour. We're not a comedy podcast, are we? I don't even know what we call this.
We are categorized partially in
comedy.
Comedy. On iTunes.
Right.
But it's kind of more...
thought, what are we? We
have cultural analysis? Highbrow cultural analysis?
Yes, from your ivory tower of UCLA. That's right.
I don't know, from inside the trenches of show business.
Yeah,
I
mean, that's something.
You know what I do know?
What's that?
We've been changing the way people have been listening to the internet since May of 2007.
It's true.
We're approaching our four-year anniversary.
Absolutely.
And numbers. You can find many episodes
many.
Of your Chilpack Hollywood Hour. Eventually, someday, all the episodes.
Think of that.
Chilpack Hollywood Hour, though it'll take us a couple years to get them all back online.
We're going
to
work on it.
At chillpackhollywood.com, C-H-I-L-L-P-A-K Hollywood.com. You can download and stream the episodes and even subscribe via iTunes through ChillpackHollywood.com. You can become a friend of the show on MySpace at MySpace.com/ChillpackHollywood. Be a liker of the show on Facebook at Facebook.com/ChillpackHollywood.
Like us.
You can follow Dean Haglund on
yes,
Twitter.
Sure do. D Haglund.
Twitter.com/D Haglund, and I'm Twitter.com/Phil Larness.
Easy to do.
We'll see you next week.
Take care, everybody.